Hey, everybody, and welcome back to The Deep Dive.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, so, you know, our listeners sent in some really, really interesting stuff this week. One in particular caught my eye, an article called America's Growth Ponzi Scheme. Pretty provocative title, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely an attention grabber, for sure.
Yeah, so I thought it would be great to kind of dig into this with you and really explore what this whole Ponzi scheme idea is all about and maybe even more importantly, what it might mean for our neck of the woods here, Deer Park, La Porte, Pasadena, you know, those areas.
Sounds good to me. I've been looking forward to unpacking this one. I mean, the author, Charles Marone, he's the founder of Strong Towns, and, you know, he's a land use planner and a civil engineer.
Wow. So he's really in the thick of it.
Yeah. He's not just some armchair theorist. He really understands how communities are built and financed. And he makes this really compelling argument that the way North America has developed since World War II has some fundamental financial weaknesses.
Okay. So let's dive into this whole, you know, Ponzi scheme analogy. I mean, it's a pretty strong claim, right?
Yeah.
It is. And it's not something to be taken lightly.
Yeah. So where do we even begin with this?
Well, Marone starts by painting this picture of how human settlements have evolved over centuries, right? Like for the vast majority of human history, towns and cities grew organically, kind of gradually and pretty much in the same basic patterns, no matter where you were in the world.
Right. Makes sense. I mean, people needed access to water and food and ways to get around and trade. So you'd kind of see those same patterns emerging everywhere.
Exactly. Then boom, World War II ends and everything changes.
Yeah. It's like somebody flipped a switch or something, right?
Yeah.
I mean, think about the sheer scale of growth and change that happened in North America after the war. It's mind-boggling.
It really is. I mean, Marone uses this example of a Roman from antiquity suddenly being plopped down in a modern American city, like in the year 2020. And he says that this person would be utterly lost, completely disoriented.
Wow, I can only imagine.
But then he contrasts that with what would happen if that same Roman were transported to an American city in the 1920s. And he argues that they would actually find it relatively familiar. The basic layout, the way people got around, the pace of life,
yeah. It
would all seem somewhat recognizable.
So what he's getting at is that the post-World War II period represents a truly radical departure from the way humans had built settlements for, like, millennia, right?
Exactly. And it's tempting to say, okay, well, the car, that's the big game changer, right?
Yeah.
More cars equals more sprawl, end of story.
Yeah, I can see how you might jump to that conclusion.
But Marone's point is much deeper than that.
Yeah.
He argues that the financial motivations behind this shift were just, if not more significant, than the technological innovations.
So it wasn't just about people wanting bigger houses and more space. It was tied into something bigger.
Exactly. The economic hardships of the 1930s and 40s, the Great Depression, World War II, these created this really strong societal desire for growth, for job creation, for a more prosperous middle class. And that really shaped the decisions that were made about how and where to build.
Right. So we had this kind of perfect storm circumstances, this pent-up demand, and then all these new technologies and ideas about how to build communities. Yeah. And it wasn't just happening organically. It was being actively encouraged at a national level, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The federal government played a huge role in promoting this shift through policies that encouraged home ownership, massive investments in highway infrastructure, streamlining financial mechanisms.
Right.
It was a nationally coordinated project aimed at achieving specific economic and social goals.
So in a way, it was kind of an unprecedented experiment, right?
Exactly. And like any experiment, there were both successes and unintended consequences.
Yeah. So in those early decades after the war, by many measures, this model seemed to be working, right? I mean, you saw rising wages, decreasing unemployment, strong economic growth. For many people, there was a tangible sense of progress.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But it's crucial to acknowledge that this prosperity wasn't evenly distributed. As Marone points out, many communities and individuals, particularly in urban areas and communities of color, were left behind or even actively harmed by these policies.
Right. So there's a whole other layer to this story about equity and social justice that we need to keep in mind.
Absolutely. But even setting those issues aside for a moment, Marone argues that there was a fundamental flaw built into the financial structure of this suburban experiment, a flaw that has led to what he calls America's growth Ponzi scheme.
Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty of this Ponzi scheme analogy, because that's a pretty loaded term.
Yeah, no kidding. So how does a Ponzi scheme work? Basically, you're promising investors big returns, but you're not actually generating any real profits. So you're using money from new investors to pay off the earlier investors, and you keep kicking the can down the road, hoping that nobody notices until it all eventually collapses.
Sounds pretty shady.
Oh, is. And Marone argues that the way we finance suburban expansion has a similar dynamic.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Break it down for me.
He identifies three primary mechanisms of local economic growth since World War II. The first is transfer payments from federal or state levels. Think of things like infrastructure grants or community development block grants.
Okay, so that's money coming from outside the community.
Exactly. The second mechanism is transportation spending, huge investments in highways and roads, which essentially opened up vast new areas for development on the fringes of existing towns and cities.
And that makes that land more valuable and creates opportunities for developers to come in and build.
Precisely. And then the third mechanism is debt, both public and private debt, being used to finance all this new infrastructure and development.
Right. So it's this combination of outside money, infrastructure spending, and borrowed money that fuels this whole cycle of growth.
Exactly. And for local governments, the initial appeal of this model is pretty clear. When a new subdivision or shopping mall gets built, they get permit fees, connection charges for utilities, and expanded property tax base. It's an immediate influx of revenue.
Right. I can see how that would be tempting.
But here's the catch. Along with that revenue comes a long-term obligation, the responsibility to maintain and eventually replace all that new infrastructure. The roads, the water and sewer lines, the sidewalks, the streetlights, everything that makes those new neighborhoods function.
And that stuff isn't cheap.
Not at all. And that's where the Ponzi scheme analogy comes in. Because over the lifespan of these developments, cities often collect only about 10 to 20 cents in revenue for every dollar of long-term infrastructure liability they incur.
Well, wait a minute. So they're essentially spending a dollar to get back 10 or 20 cents. That doesn't sound like a very good deal.
It's not. And it's not sustainable. And Marone uses this really powerful phrase to describe this situation. He calls it a ridiculously low level of financial productivity.
And why is this happening? Is it just bad management, or are there deeper structural reasons why this model is so financially unproductive?
It's a complex issue, but part of the problem is that sprawl development patterns are inherently more expensive to maintain per capita than more compact traditional development patterns.
So the more spread out you are, the more it costs to provide basic services.
Exactly. Think about the sheer miles of roads and pipes required to serve a dispersed suburban population compared to a denser walkable neighborhood.
That makes sense.
And when you combine that with the fact that these developments are often heavily subsidized by outside money and financed with debt, you have a recipe for financial instability.
So it's like a ticking time bomb just waiting to go off.
In a sense, yes. Marone describes it as a ticking time bomb of unfunded liability for infrastructure maintenance.
And it's not just some abstract problem. It's going to have real consequences for real people, right?
Absolutely. He mentions the American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE estimates for deferred maintenance on major infrastructure nationwide, trillions of dollars worth of stuff that needs to be fixed or replaced.
Trillions. Yeah, that's a mind-boggling number.
But he also brings it down to the hyper-local level. The streets, the sidewalks, the water systems that people rely on every single day in their own neighborhoods.
And that's what we're talking about here, right? This is about the very places where our listeners live and work in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena.
Exactly. These communities aren't immune to this challenge. Every municipality that has followed this post-war development model is facing this growing backlog of maintenance needs, these implicit promises made to residents when development was approved, but without a clear and reliable funding mechanism in place for the decades to come.
So what can be done about this? I mean, it sounds like a pretty intractable problem.
It is a huge challenge, but it's not hopeless.
Yeah.
The first step is recognizing and acknowledging the problem.
Okay, awareness, that's always the first step, right?
Exactly. And then we need to start having honest conversations about the true costs and consequences of different development patterns and financial decisions.
So are there any specific things that cities have tried to do to address this issue?
Yeah, the article points out a couple of common responses that cities have had to this challenge, and neither of them is ideal.
Okay, lay it on me.
The first and perhaps most common response is to try and grow even faster, to annex more land, approve more development, in the hope that the additional tax revenue will cover the existing shortfalls. But as Marone points out, this is the classic hallmark of a Ponzi scheme. You constantly need new participants to pay off the obligations to earlier investors.
It's like a hamster wheel. You just keep running and running, but you're not actually getting anywhere.
Exactly. And in the context of cities, this can fuel unsustainable real estate bubbles and just postpone the inevitable reckoning.
So it's not a real solution, just a temporary fix.
Right. And the second common response is an increasing reliance on debt.
Ah, yes, the good old credit card solution.
Yeah, but just like individuals, municipalities can get caught in a cycle of borrowing to cover existing obligations, which only makes the underlying problem worse.
Right, because now you're paying interest on top of everything else.
Exactly. And Marone notes that this trend really accelerated in the 1970s and became increasingly complex, even predatory in some ways, leading up to the foreclosure crisis.
So it's not a sustainable path either.
No, it's a sign of financial distress, not financial health.
Okay, so if these two common responses are essentially dead ends, then what's the alternative?
Well, that's where the Strong Towns approach comes in.
Okay, so tell me more about that.
The Strong Towns philosophy is all about building financially resilient communities, communities that are designed to be productive over the long term, not just in the short term.
So it's about taking a different approach to growth.
Right. It's about recognizing that not all growth is created equal.
So what does that look like in practice?
Well, it involves a lot of things, but some of the key principles include things like focusing on incremental development, building things gradually and in response to actual demand, rather than trying to create huge mega projects all at once.
Okay, so it's about being more strategic and deliberate with growth.
Exactly. And it also involves prioritizing maintenance over new construction, taking care of the assets we already have, rather than always chasing the next shiny new thing.
That's sense. I mean, if you don't take care of what you have, it's just going to fall apart eventually.
Right. And then another key piece is promoting diverse local economies, economies that are resilient to shocks and changes rather than being overly dependent on any one industry or sector.
So spreading the risk, making sure you have multiple eggs in your basket, so to speak.
Precisely. And it also means empowering local communities to make decisions about their own future rather than being dictated to by top-down policies or outside developers.
So it's about local control and self-determination.
Exactly. And fundamentally, it's about shifting our mindset away from this idea that growth is always good no matter what, and towards a more nuanced understanding of how different types of growth can have very different impacts on a community's long-term financial health.
So the central argument here isn't that there hasn't been economic growth over the past 70 years, but that much of that growth has been, in a financial sense, unproductive. It's created a situation where communities are constantly chasing more growth just to manage the liabilities created by previous growth. It's growth driven by necessity, not necessarily by genuine prosperity.
That's a great way to put it. And Marone argues that this pattern has generated what he calls an illusion of wealth. We see the new buildings, the expanded infrastructure, but beneath the surface is this ever-increasing burden of long-term costs that aren't being adequately accounted for or funded. And now he says that illusion is beginning to crumble, contributing to the widespread financial fragility and instability we're observing at the local level across the country.
So this Ponzi scheme analogy, it's not just some abstract economic theory. It has real-world implications for the places we live and care about.
Absolutely. And it raises some really important questions for communities like Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena.
Yeah. I mean, what does this mean for our listeners in those areas?
Well, it means we need to start asking some tough questions about how our communities are growing and how we're paying for that growth.
So things like, what are the infrastructure obligations that have accumulated over the years in these areas? And what is the financial productivity of the development patterns we've seen?
Exactly. And how can we shift towards a more sustainable model of development, one that prioritizes long-term financial resilience over short-term gains?
It's a lot to think about.
It is. But it's crucial that we start having these conversations now before it's too late.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to leave it for today. This has been a really eye-opening discussion, and I hope our listeners will take this information and start asking those tough questions in their own communities.
Me too. I think it's time for us to really start thinking about how to build strong towns for the future.
Well said. Thanks for joining me on this deep dive.
My pleasure.
And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in. As always, we appreciate your support. And if you'd like to support us even further, please consider making a donation at thinkanddacklocally.com/donate. You can find the link in the show notes. Until next time, stay curious and keep thinking and acting locally.
See you next time.